From South Dakota to Florida, Indiana to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Trump is voicing concerns over the integrity of the election process, and both Republicans and Democrats are preparing to challenge the validity of the results. Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation is here to discuss. Violent protests have rocked Kenosha, Wisconsin, again putting law and order front and center in the presidential election. For a look at the impact, Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. Although the focus has been on the U.S. Postal Service, the real challenges of voting by mail lie elsewhere. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Yuval Levin of the American Enterprise Institute. And allegations of corruption have dogged members of Joe Biden's family. Will that be an issue in the presidential campaign? Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explores on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The left has never accepted results of the 2016 presidential election, and President Trump is already questioning the integrity of the 2020 electoral process. So is there reason for concern? Hans von Spakovsky is senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He is here now to discuss issues related to ballot security. Hans, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Hans, President Trump has talked a lot about whether or not this election is going to be stolen. And one of the mechanisms by which he fears election improprieties centers around the whole issue of these mail-in ballots, especially universal mail-in balloting. First of all, are the president's fears grounded? Is there a reason to be concerned?
Yes, there is a reason to be concerned. That's because absentee or mail-in ballots are those that are most vulnerable to fraud, to being stolen, to being altered, and to voters being pressured and coerced to vote a particular way.
In terms of the security of those ballots, especially you have states like, I believe it was New Jersey, Hans, that are going to just mail them out to all registered voters. So you have millions of live ballots floating around out there. There's no real chain of custody. Is that a concern as well?
It's a big concern, particularly because the voter registration rolls across the country are in notoriously bad condition in terms of their accuracy. States aren't doing a good job of maintaining them so that they're up to date. They don't do a good job of taking off people who have died, people who've moved away or otherwise become ineligible. So if you're going to simply mail out a ballot to every registered voter, you're literally going to have tens of thousands of ballots arriving in neighborhoods, arriving in mailboxes, apartment buildings, condominiums, for individuals who don't live there anymore, who have died. And the problem is ballots are a very, very valuable commodity, and they may get collected by folks who may try to vote them.
Talk a little bit more about that. The term we often hear is ballot harvesting. Tell us what that term means, and is this illegal in most states?
Unfortunately, in about half of the states, it's legal. What vote harvesting means is this. Look, when you vote, for example, by absentee ballot, you can mail it back. Of course, that makes you dependent on the U.S. Postal Service delivering it in time. Or you can hand deliver it yourself, or a member of your family can hand deliver it. But in about half of the states legalize anybody being able to deliver your absentee ballot. So what does that mean? Well, it means that candidates, campaign staffers, party activists, political consultants can show up at your front door, ask for your absentee ballot, and offer to deliver it. Well, the problem with that is, one, it subjects voters to pressure and coercion by those individuals showing up at your front door. And second, it puts the ballot in the hands of third parties who have a stake in the outcome of the election. And there have been plenty of cases involving absentee ballot fraud that show that all kinds of things happen, from those individuals actually filling out the ballot instead of the voter filling it out, to them pressuring the voters to actually forging signatures and filling out the ballots themselves.
Some states, of course, have been conducting their elections largely by mail-in ballot. And I would particularly like you to talk for a minute or so, Hans, about New York and the fact in this recent primary, It was weeks after the primary before we had a result because of irregularities. Is that something that we're going to have as we head into this election in November, where we're going to take days, if not weeks, to know what's actually happened?
It took 6 weeks, if you can believe that, for New York to count the results from its June 23rd primary. And those results are now being contested in court, part of the reason being that they had a huge rejection rate. 1 in 5 ballots returned by voters were rejected by election officials for everything from signatures not matching to the voter not providing all the information they need to provide, to the U.S. Postal Service neglecting to postmark the ballot envelope so that election officials didn't know whether the ballot had actually been mailed by the end of election day. That's a huge disenfranchisement rate, 20%. And so that's now being litigated. So we still don't really know the outcome of some of the races in New York.
The whole issue of the United States Postal Service has been front and center over the last couple of weeks. Nancy Pelosi and the U.S. House of Representatives even coming in for a rare Saturday session for a vote on what was really a messaging bill. But Hans, as you look at the United States Postal Service, is it your judgment that they, in fact, have the capability to handle this number of ballots? Is there something to the fact that the Postal Service may not be able to get the job done?
I don't think they're going to be able to get the job done, although it's not from a lack of money. What we've seen in every single primary that's been held since the COVID-19 health crisis came upon us is the Postal Service misdelivering mail, either not delivering it to voters at all or delivering it too late for it to be counted. And that has happened. That happened in Wisconsin, in New York, Maryland, District of Columbia. And that is a general problem. Yeah, they may be able to deliver most of the ballots, but if they miss delivering 4 or 5%, that translates into tens of thousands of voters who miss their chance to vote, because the Postal Service cannot guarantee 100% delivery on time of mail-in ballots.
So for somebody who plans on voting by mail, maybe because they're not going to be near their home precinct on Election Day, Hans, or they have a health problem and they're concerned about COVID-19, what advice do you have for the individual voter so that they can get their ballot casted and ensure that it ends up in the proper place and is actually counted?
Well, don't wait till just before Election Day, because the Postal Service may not be able to deliver your ballot. Also, you know, they might not postmark your ballot, in which case it won't be counted either. If you're going to do this, you need to vote your ballot well before Election Day. And I would urge you to either hand deliver it yourself to election officials or get a member of your family to hand deliver it to election officials. Of course, if you do that, you vote weeks before the election. If any kind of information comes out shortly before the election, information that's important to you and the choices you've made, guess what? It's going to be too late to change your vote. You're much better off voting in person.
We have been talking with Hans von Spakovsky, who is Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And Hans, tell us a bit about Heritage. Also, you've written very extensively on this topic. Tell us where folks can go to read those writings.
Sure. The Heritage Foundation is the largest conservative think tank in the world. And if you go to heritage.org, you can not only find my analysis on voting issues, but our analysis and policy proposals on foreign and domestic policy of every kind.
Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. Hans, thank you for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
At the Club for Growth, Scott Parkinson has been keeping an eye on the Republican National Convention. The polls are tightening, and we have more civil unrest. We're going to talk about all of those things today. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you. Good morning, Loman.
Well, now we've had the Republican National Convention, and it was markedly different, Scott, both in terms of tone and presentation. Tell us your thoughts on the convention.
I think that this was an opportunity for the Republicans and President Trump to highlight the diversity of candidates, the diversity of leaders that we have in the Republican Party, and really to talk about key issues and sort of previewing what a second term might look like for him. So it's been a lot of fun for me to watch. I think that obviously the pomp and circumstance that you would normally see in a convention setting is clearly subdued due to the pandemic, but there was really good presentation from folks from the president all the way down to key members of the administration and candidates running for public office in key battleground districts in America. So when we saw people like Madison Cawthorn get up out of his wheelchair and stand for the flag, and then when you hear other candidates like Burgess Owens from Utah talk about being a first-round pick in the NFL and falling down into a family of six in a one-bedroom basement and having to rebuild his life, there's a lot of Republicans that are thinking about how they're going to rebuild after the pandemic, after they've lost their small business, after they've lost their jobs. And I think that President Trump's narrative that he highlighted through the convention is an optimistic one, and one hopefully that can rebound our country into the strength that we certainly had prior to the pandemic.
In a typical year, which of course this isn't, after a convention, a candidate usually gets somewhat of a bounce in the polls. Now, Joe Biden probably didn't get that much of a bounce because the conventions were held so closely together. But looking at the polling already, we've seen the polls tightening. What are you seeing in the battleground states, Scott?
During the Republican convention, so this isn't even post-convention, there was polling released by CNBC Change Research. And what that showed was six swing states tightening over the past couple of weeks. That includes states like Arizona, Florida, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And a lot of these voters highlighted their concerns about the coronavirus. And clearly, that's a very, very serious issue on voters' minds. Meanwhile, we've seen sort of this law and order issue percolating in the suburbs even more over the last week with what's happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and to an extent back in Minnesota again. So, you know, I think that there's really a lot of folks that are now starting to pay attention to the presidential election. And we've always known this was going to be a close race. So the way that I kind of view post-convention is the campaign is now finally underway, and the next benchmarks that'll be interesting to watch will be the debates, assuming that Joe Biden and Donald Trump can agree to show up at them.
Let's talk a little bit more about this. It's called a law and order issue, but it's really more about personal safety and security. Scott, the suburban areas around the country had been trending toward Democrats for the last couple of cycles, largely based on the healthcare issue. But now that you have this civil unrest in the inner cities and mayors and Democratic governors unable or unwilling to try and get a handle and quell the violence, is this playing into what could be a major game-changing issue for the president and Republicans?
Absolutely. I think it is. Going around our country in 2018, The seats that the Democrats picked up were largely these suburban swing districts that took a hard turn left, and Democrats throttled the Republicans largely on that healthcare messaging. But right now you're hearing from a lot of voters that are really concerned about the safety of their own community, and the violent protests, the rioting, the destruction of property and business on Main Street is now a top issue in the campaign. And what's happening with racial injustice is clearly unfortunate. We all want the law to treat the American people equally. But at the same time, there are going to be issues that jump around in terms of priority for key swing voters. And I think that this, you know, Make America Safe Again message that we're starting to hear is really going to swing that potential voter in these key districts. It puts the House in play. It gives us a stronger chance at winning the Senate and making sure that we maintain the GOP majority. And I think it helps Donald Trump in his reelection. So we've got November 3rd right around the corner. You and I are going to blink 10 times and it's going to be here. But let's take a hard look at what the gettable voters are thinking about. And right now, at the end of August, we know that they're definitely thinking about safety in their community They're thinking about education. They're thinking about the economy. And they're going to have to look at the two candidates and decide which one positions the United States of America best in order to have a full economic recovery, in order to have safety and security in the communities, and in order to extend a quality education to all students.
Does this now begin to put pressure, particularly on the Biden campaign, that you have this unrest, these riots and looting and lawlessness that are taking place in inner cities, all controlled by Democrat mayors and Democrat governors? Does this put Biden in a spot where he's going to have to take a look at these tightening polls and perhaps start changing his messaging?
Yeah, he did put out a video statement after Kenosha, but to me, it just seems unauthentic when you can clearly watch a candidate moving their eyes to the teleprompter.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're based out of our nation's capital. And if anybody, any listeners out there want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Thank you, Scott. We'll check in with you next week. Take care.
Thanks.
Funding for the U.S. Postal Service isn't the real challenge to efficient voting by mail. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Yuval Levin of the American Enterprise Institute.
It looks like a lot of Americans are going to vote by mail this year, and that poses certain challenges for the electoral system, and those challenges don't end on Election Day. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Yuval Levin. He is the Director of Social, Cultural, and Constitutional Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also the founder and editor-in-chief of National Affairs Magazine, and he's a frequent op-ed contributor at National Review. He's a very busy guy, as you can tell, but he has taken some of his time today to join us for a few minutes, and we appreciate you being here, Yuval.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
One of your recent pieces at National Review that caught my eye, the headline on this was The Real Challenge of Voting by Mail. Now, obviously, there are going to be a lot more votes cast by mail this year than ever before. And that was probably true, actually, even before the pandemic hit, because that's been the trend for the last few elections. But and now it's even more true. And the real challenge here, as you say, is not necessarily the mail part, but really what comes after that.
Yeah, that's right. I do think that we've seen an increase in voting by mail for the last four or five election cycles, and we would have had a lot of it anyway this coming year. There were about 30 million people voting by mail in 2016. I think it would have been higher than that. But what we're going to see in November is much more than that, of course, because of the pandemic. And the challenge of voting by mail is not that there's a particularly high danger of fraud. There's certainly some instances of fraud, as there are with in-person voting. But there's not a pattern of fraud. The problem is logistical. The problem is managing the process and the systems involved for signature verification. The problem is getting things in on time, making sure that date stamps are correct and signatures are verified and people have a chance to review if there's a concern. All of that takes time. And if we're going to see much more voting by mail than usual, especially in states that are not accustomed to it, I think it's safe to expect that there will be some huge logistical messes, especially if it's a close election.
Yeah, it seems like that's especially true in states that, as you said there, states that haven't really spent the time and money that's necessary to build out a true vote-by-mail system. It seems like a lot of states are just kind of piggybacking onto their existing absentee ballot system. And there's also been some confusion about the distinction, or if there even is a distinction, between voting by mail and absentee balloting. I wonder if you can just tell us a little bit about that.
There are really only five states that run their elections mainly by mail. Colorado and Hawaii, Oregon, Utah, and Washington. They've been doing it for a while. And in those states, most people vote by mail, and they've got the technology and the system set up for it, and they don't expect major problems. In a lot of other states, what you've got is an absentee ballot system, which basically an absentee ballot is voting by mail, but you have to request it, and then you receive it, and you have to submit it well before Election Day. Some states, as you say, are just going to use that system and assume that a lot more people are going to request ballots. Some states are sending ballots to everyone, but basically using what they would do for absentee balloting, including the dates they would use and everything else. And some states are trying to create a real vote-by-mail system on the fly. all of these make sense, but they're all going to run into trouble because of scale. There are just going to be a lot more people voting by mail. And what we found in the primaries this year, which has been the only real test of voting during COVID, is that voting by mail increased dramatically and that there were real problems. The Washington Post did a tally of rejected ballots in the primaries. They were only able to get information from 23 states, but they found 500,000 ballots in those states were rejected, which is obviously a very large number in a close election. I mean, the 2016 election basically came down to about 80,000 votes in three states, and the Post found that in those three states, in the primaries, there were 60,000 rejected ballots, mail-in ballots. So you have to assume in the national election there will be vastly more than that. And if it's a close election, that's going to mean that there are real logistical concerns about how to count votes and how to interpret results. And in an election where the numbers are much larger than usual, it could be a huge problem.
Oh, well, at least it's a good thing that the stakes aren't too high right now, right? We are talking with Yuval Levin from the American Enterprise Institute. We are talking with him about the challenges that come with mail-in voting. Just about a minute left here, Yuval. But I don't want to let you go before we talk about this idea that you floated in this recent piece that you wrote for National Review. There's been some talk about maybe postponing the election because of the pandemic, but you say it's not the election that should be postponed, but rather some post-election deadlines that I think a lot of people maybe don't even know exist. So tell us a little bit about what you mean.
Yeah,
there.
I certainly don't think the election date should be changed, but there are ways that Congress can give the states more time to count the presidential election ballots. This would only affect the presidential race. But what happens after the election is that the Electoral College has to meet. The deadline is now December 8th for the states to certify results, and then the Electoral College meets December 14th. And there's really no reason that has to happen in early and mid-December. It could happen at the beginning of January. And it happens in December because of federal law, not state law. And so a simple bill in Congress could move those dates back by 3 weeks and give the states just more time to count. I think part of what we could run into is if there are these logistical problems, states will just run out of time. That's actually what happened in Florida in 2000, where the state was still counting on the date that its deadline for certifying the Electoral College results came, and the Supreme Court intervened. I think by just giving the states a little more time, you could avoid one kind of disaster we might encounter. But I think it's very hard to predict in advance what kinds of disasters we might encounter, and we should expect that we won't have results on election night and that it'll take some time, and that doesn't mean that the results are not legitimate. That's a message that has got to be gotten out there well in advance of the election.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. People need to be patient. We don't have a political culture that really values patience right now, but we might be waiting for a while for election results to be finalized this year. Unfortunately, we do have hard deadlines on this show, so I'm going to have to let you go, but thank you so much for joining us today, Yuval.
Thanks very much.
And again, that is Yuval Levin. He is the Director of Social, Cultural, and Constitutional Studies at the American Enterprise Institute and the founder and editor-in-chief of National Affairs Magazine. You can check out his work at AEI.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out everything we're working on at Reason.com, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Allegations of corruption and using his public position to benefit members of his family have dogged Joe Biden for years. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA takes a look at the issue on this American Radio Journal commentary.
I will begin today by talking about corruption, especially political corruption. It takes many forms, and we will identify some of them. But by the end of this commentary, I will tighten our focus on the uniquely clever corruption practiced by the Biden family. For the definition and examples of corruption, I will use what is generally regarded as the left-leaning Transparency International organization and its website, transparency.org. Their definition is pretty simple. It's the abuse of entrusted power for private gain. Note that it says private gain, not personal gain. Personal gain is most often interpreted as referring to the corrupt person's own gain. But it doesn't need to be his or her own gain to be corrupt. It can and often does apply to the person who has the public trust abusing power by steering the private gain to another individual, such as a donor, an associate, or a family member. So let's go over our definition again. Corruption is defined as the abuse of public trust or power for private gain. Now, corruption can involve anyone, politicians, government officials, public servants, business people, or members of the public, and corruption happens in the shadows. Corruption adapts to different contexts and changing circumstances, and it can evolve in response to changes in rules, legislation, or even technology. There are at least two lessons to be drawn from this. The first is that an elected official may be thoroughly corrupt without ever personally receiving private benefits from corrupt acts. The second is that things that occur in the shadows are easily ignored. What is meant by the shadows? It simply means not in the bright glare of public awareness. In many cases, the corrupt acts may be easily discovered and documented, but they never make it into the broad public awareness simply because the mainstream media chooses not to cover them. Both of these lessons may be directly applied to the actions of Joe Biden when he was vice president. One of the courageous investigators willing to go where the mainstream media turns a blind eye is Peter Schweitzer of the Government Accountability Institute. Earlier this year, he released a book titled Profiles in Corruption. The book meticulously details and documents corruption of several heroes of the modern progressive movement, including Barack Obama and Kamala Harris, but the most damning revelations are those clearly identifying how five members of the Biden family benefited from the actions of the then vice president. That former Vice President Biden himself received relatively few of the private benefits is no exoneration. It is still using public office to create private gain that lies at the heart of the definition of corruption. Not benefiting himself directly does not absolve him of the charge of corruption that the mainstream media and the left-leaning commentariat so willfully dismiss. Now Schweitzer is working on a kind of sequel to his work that will soon be released as a movie, which may earn a wider audience for his research than his books. The trailer for the movie is expected to be released as soon as next week, and the full version, about 40 minutes in length, in a few weeks. I urge all American Radio Journal listeners to be on the lookout for both the trailer and the final film. The working title is Riding the Dragon, and it zeroes in on how five members of the Biden family received benefits, some of them quite lucrative, from the vice president's corrupt acts regarding China. Don't fall for the media's eager dismissal of Schweitzer's charges on the basis that the VP himself didn't put cash in his own pocket. Focus instead on how his actions perfectly fit the definition of corruption. Is this a man whom the American public should trust to conduct foreign affairs with our largest and richest adversary? This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WRSKLP in Newton, New Jersey, WERG-FM in Erie, Pennsylvania, along with KFBX-AM in Fairbanks, Alaska. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.